Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host of Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Today, we're supposed to have on with us Donna Winnett, founder of Families, Friends, and Individuals for Mentally Ill, as well as other advocates with a passion for prison release reform, mainly in areas of mental health treatment. Speaking on the core of issues of a failed system and what needs to take place in order for positive changes to occur for a decrease in mass incarceration. We also are going to have on with us Jen Mather. Jen has also been involved with clients in various areas of need, including and especially those who are suffering from psychological or mental illnesses. We know there's a problem in this country as far as mental illnesses and addictions throughout the country. It's become a major issue because all mental institutions have been closed, and as a result, everyone who has suffered or is suffering from mental illnesses or addictions are being thrown into prisons, which is not helping them with their mental illness issues or their addiction. We have a weak system, a dysfunctional system when it comes to incarceration. And so we are going to welcome Jen Mather. She's going to speak on some of these issues as well as her experiences and her knowledge in these areas of the field. So Jen, are you on with us? Jen, can you hear us? We're having a problem with hearing from Jen. She's on the air with us, but apparently there's a... Are you on speaker or are you on mute, Jen? Okay, she dropped. She'll probably be coming back on. I don't know what the issue is with the sound, but we're having a little difficulty here. Thank you for your patience, audience. We will get this straightened out soon. Let me see if we can hear from her now. Jen, can you hear us? Jen? What the problem is? Okay. Jen, I can hear just something vaguely in the background. It sounds like a little, I don't know, some kind of thumping or something. But I don't hear your voice. I see her on the air. I hear something, and it sounds like something in the
background.
I'm
gonna retry it. Can you hear me at all?
Okay.
Can you hear me at all?
Yeah, we hear you. We hear you now, loud and clear.
Okay.
I am so sorry. I am so sorry.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on, but I have
I'm sorry. I tried four times to get in. So.
And I kept talking to you, but you couldn't hear me. I've already introduced you to the audience.
Yeah, I was texting you going, okay. I just sent you messages saying I'm lagging. I'm trying. I'm reloading it. I don't know what's going on. I can't hear.
No,
so.
periodically, these things happen, and it's happened with others who have done the show on Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah.
So I need to report that to the administrator of the radio show here. But Jen, can you, again, introduce yourself to the audience and talk a little bit about yourself? And Donna had mentioned that she wanted to do the once a month, and I don't know if she's coming on today or if she's coming on next week. But if you can get started, that would be great.
My name is Jennifer Mather. I work as an advocate for the New Visions organization. I'm currently working with some of the inpatient population who is inmates who are incarcerated and are looking at being released in the future. Most individuals who've been juveniles who've been convicted and have done decades behind bars and are looking at coming out into the community, and looking at the fact that they receiving very minimal transition into the community at that point. So looking at working with them and working with ways to rehabilitate so they have more skills when they are eventually released. Also, I was formerly a clinician. I worked with juvenile offenders in the court system. And as a clinician, I worked with high-risk families and assessments and placement for doing for the courts and for in general, basically. I worked with inpatient and outpatient settings in Massachusetts. And now that volunteer for your organization as well. And I've been speaking on podcasts about crime, mental health, and how it impacts people, and on issues that come up, kind of how society, ways that we can look to prevent people from venturing into crime, and how we can help prevent people reentering it from the criminal justice system into society to help prevent them from reoffending, or sort of get the numbers down, because right now the recidivism rate is very high, and the system is a very broken system. So last week we were talking about what they now call legal abuse syndrome, and the week before that we were talking about basically what root of problems are, and so we sort of addressed family issues last week is one aspect of that, and so we can kind of go from there and see what thoughts are, I guess.
I wanted to, with everything you just said, Jen, about your experiences in the areas that you have been involved in, I want the audience to know it's all of these different issues and areas that Jen was talking about being involved in. This is what has given her a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge into what goes on in the community, and also in the penal system with our incarcerated and our people in the free world, in the communities who are suffering from all kinds of illnesses. And mainly it is mental illnesses, psychological illnesses, addiction, and even wrongful convictions while incarcerated. But this is why it's very important for people in the communities and you, audience that is listening now, this is why it's so imperative that you try to get involved in these kind of things, whether it be volunteering or whether it be actually going out there and doing something, you know, trying to help in these areas. There was a time when they had mental institutions out there to deal with these mental illnesses, and those are gone. And when they closed all of these institutions down, a lot of these people were either put in the streets, a lot of them were sent to May Institute and to other organizations that dealt, in this case with May Institute, they deal with autism. But at the same time, they were taking in some individuals that also had other mental illnesses. So audience, I want you to hear what's going on today, to hear more about some of these things that are going on behind the prison walls and in the communities. And please try to get connected with Jen. Try to get connected with Families and Friends for Mentally Ill, or NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Try to get involved with a lot of these groups that are on Facebook that are actually dealing and trying to make changes. Try to get involved with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. FAM has been around for years, and FAM is about reducing the harsh incarceration sentencing, while at the same time trying to do away with some of these things that are going on in the communities and in the prisons. So I encourage all of you to please contact your legislative members and try to get them to stop going into the prisons and meeting with these prisoners, listening to them, finding out what it is that they are in need of. And I thank you so much, Jen, again, for coming on. And if you want to talk more about some of these issues that you see arising or occurring in the prisons, we do need to stop this mass incarceration. We're the only country in the world that has 2.3 million people in prisons and jails, and it needs to stop. As Jen said, the recidivism rate is very, very high. The suicide rates around the country in prisons, especially those who have been in solitary confinement and on restrictive housing units, need to stop. It needs to stop. So, Jen, I'm going to hand it back over to you. Thank you so much.
I can see that when they closed a lot of the hospitals, and I mean, I could say even from the time I stopped working in Massachusetts to now, the whole system has completely changed. And you had a lot of kids that were put in residential, and you had a lot of kids that were put in, they were put in short-term hospital stays and all of that. I don't know if it's insurance that changed. I don't know, but I see a lot of the places that I used to work with, a lot of the facilities are gone. I mean, they're just gone. And I don't know what resources are out there anymore for a big population. I know it was a pretty sized population of kids in the state that I worked with. It's just not there. And I don't think that the at-risk youth certainly haven't healed. It's not like there's not a need for it. But it just blows my mind that the amount of, like you said, May Institute was one. There was other facilities for the May Institute. We worked with kids, I remember, too, if I remember correctly. They had kids and adults. And it wasn't just autism when I was working. It was a whole host of things at the time. And there's many people who work there. But all of these facilities closed. And, I mean, they actually did work with other groups of people because you had cost sharing, which was a huge issue. And that may have been part of the reason. But it's a huge problem in Massachusetts. I look in California where I am. And, I mean, I decided one day to just walk around where I live. And I don't see it so much in Massachusetts to the epidemic portion that it is in California. But there's just tents and tarps of people sleeping everywhere, all over the streets. And I don't want to say that they're all ex-cons because I don't know that. I would say a lot of them probably have been, or it's a result of them passing laws that let people out of prison just early and changing what the felony system is. But these people, a lot of them, many of them are, I'm stepping over needles, I'm stepping over urine, feces, you name it. And these people live in a squander. They were let out of prison. Their substance abuse issues, if they had them before, were never addressed. If they didn't have them, they have them now because they've got other issues that haven't been addressed. The community members are all up in arms because it's not a pleasant thing to see. You don't want your kids and stuff like that seeing this. You have, mentally ill people coming up, and I have had experiences with them coming up and grabbing my children and screaming at them in the face. And they need help. Your kids need help. I mean, they clearly need help. And this, people then yell at the social workers who are overstaffed. They don't have the capacity to deal with it. The adult social workers, don't even the kid social workers, again, overstaffed. Nobody's seeing the help that they need. There's not enough staff. They complain, and it's not a field where people want to go into because, at that point, the population is too dangerous for a lot of people. They're not trained properly to deal with them. And the pay isn't desirable enough for what they have to deal with. They're not paid well enough to deal with a case overload. And, it's just the whole system it doesn't make it look desirable enough for anyone to ever want to go into it, I guess I could say. And the people that are there are angry, they're overburdened, they're frustrated, they're yelled at by people constantly. I mean, the whole thing is, I can see why it's a failure. And it's a failure on every level. And so I think as people who pay taxes and stuff like that, you need to invest into the system financially. You need to invest in it personally if you want it to work. You know,
that's out of the 2.3 million incarcerated individuals, they say the experts believe nearly 500,000 are mentally ill, according to the national.
I mean, I know that, like, I think it was Donna was talking about the privately funded agencies. I mean, I know I was never, when I had to do assessments, I wasn't for any side, period. I was independent. It didn't matter. I wrote a report and they could do with it what they wanted. And it wasn't, I wasn't paid by the state. I wasn't paid by a defense attorney. I was just, and that's really where that sort of stuff needs to be. It doesn't need, you know, it needs to be private companies, colleges, you know, graduate schools, that sort of stuff. And the thing is, there's so many people that could go in and do internship hours doing this. You know, it's not that there's ways to get the mental health work while people are doing residencies and stuff like that. These people aren't all, you know, people hear prison and they freak out. It's not that, you know, scary. It really isn't. You know, just because somebody committed a crime doesn't make them a, you know, inhuman individual. A lot of these people did stuff, you know, heat of a moment or whatever. And some of them are. Some of them are probably, you know, cold and callous. But for the most part, if you sat down and you had a conversation and you established a relationship with somebody, they turn out to be, there's more to them. People are more complex than how people are portrayed on TV. And you get that, you learn that after working with people. And if you go into psychology and that sort of thing, it's, you know, obviously you learn people are more complex. And so it's not like there's a shortage of staff that they could have working in the prisons. Because, you know, college, like I said, people doing internships and residencies and stuff like that, you know, there's people that could come and do it. You know, you make alliances with universities. It's really not that hard. You know, it doesn't have to be somebody's profession, but believe me, if you start there, you can handle any situation as a professional. That's just pretty much my thought. You start there, you've seen it all. It's like doing a ER residency in medical school.
I agree. And, you know, I think, too, it's a trust issue as well. As you were just saying, you know, a lot of people think that all of them are, you know, hardcore criminals and everything. But as in my experience, and I'm sure with you, it's once you start talking to them and you get familiar with them and they feel that they can trust you, they will open up more
about
what they're going through and their feelings. And this is very important that people know this, because if you don't trust someone, and we're living in a country right now at a time where no one, even the normal, per se, in the community, are trustworthy of anyone or trusting anyone. And this is the same for those who are incarcerated, you know, going through what they're going through and being, you know, degraded and everything because they have an illness.
Yeah, and a lot of them will agree they did something wrong. You know, I would say, you know, they did something wrong. They're in for a reason, you know, unless they were wrongfully convicted, you know, and they want to make a change. And from what I've talked, the majority of the people that I've spoken to, you know, that's, you know, and they're in there to make a change. It doesn't mean that, you know, they realize that they're not. The majority of the people that I've spoken to, that's pretty much, and they, you know, they're willing to, they want to learn, they want to make a difference, they want to go out and help people, they want to, you know, people not to make the same mistakes they made. And And it was funny. I don't know if you see, I saw the movie Role Models. Have you ever seen that movie?
No.
It's about two people who were, instead of going to prison, they had to be mentors to people in the community. It was a prison alternative. And I thought, what an interesting concept. If you gave people who were transitioning out, you know, to youth, like teenagers, and you gave them, and the teenagers had to sort of mentor the prisoners who, and this is what I was thinking about the youth on parole, like no life without parole. You get someone who's been behind bars for 20 years, and you pair them up with a juvenile who's, you know, it's kind of like the scared straight, but not really. And they have to teach them how to use the cell phone and teach them how to, you know, acclimate into society. And you have the person who's been in jail for 20 years, you know, teaching them, you know, not to sort of don't be where I am. And you know, like kind of like a mentoring thing. Kind of an interesting, you didn't have to watch it, but it was kind of an interesting concept. And I was like, that's kind of, yeah. They teach them how to.
Go ahead, Jen. I'm sorry.
I couldn't hear you, so I wasn't sure.
Oh, okay.
I saw it the other night, and I was like, what an interesting idea. Yeah.
Yeah, there is so much. There's so much going on. And role models, you know, speaking of role models, that's what's lacking in this country today, too. Not only with those that have psychological issues, but also even the teens, the juveniles, the adolescents,
well,
there's no role models even for them. And they, too, have psychological issues, too, when they are at that age, because they're getting ready to graduate from high school. And a lot of them are fearful, because up until now in school, they felt that they were pretty much children. And now they're going on to a higher level of you know, maturity.
Only that, you have to look at what they see in society. And, like, there's so much confusion, even just from social media, from television, from this, from that. They don't know what to, you know, as much as you want them to grow up and you think you're a good parent and you're a good role model yourself, they don't want to be like you. They want to be different. They want to be like their friends, and they want to, the peers, and they want to do what they see on Instagram and TikTok and this and that. And they're confused. And, you know, they're confused about, there's so much more that they are exposed to than I was exposed to and you were exposed to growing up. The world is such a bigger place, and it's confusing. And, you know, there's just so much, I mean, the amount of stuff, and this is what, you know, is even more frightening for people who've been behind bars for 20 years, what their life was like and what the world was like 20 years ago is so different. Like,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You say internet and they go, the inner what? That we remember the sort of internet that there was. They have no idea what it is now. I mean, and what's it going to be like in 5 years from now? Like, you know, everything moves so fast and it's so quick and so evolving that, like, and the amount is just, it's insane. Like, it's so hard to keep up with. The laws can't even keep up with them. Like, nothing can keep up with them. And, you know, our kids are, you know, unless you're very computer savvy, you have no idea what your kids are. Your kids are probably 10 years ahead of you. Like, you know.
And the thing that confuses me, even with me, it seems like as soon as you learn something, as soon as we learned this new technology, more new technology is coming out. So here, I just get used to doing things this way, and all of a sudden, Microsoft or whatever, they have something major changes. And just like this 5G, I'm still trying to figure out what 5G is all about. I can imagine what these individuals are feeling when they come out. It's terrible.
Well,
I'm
that's
sure
the thing. The stress and stuff like that, and that's why I sit there and Massachusetts gives them 6 months of a transition. They need more like 6 years, like, and that's just a start. I look at the kids that have been convicted. You have a kid who gets put behind bars at 17. They were never a child. They were never asked to support themselves. They never had to have a job. They were a minor. And so then you're saying in 6 months, before release, you know, mind you, they never, I don't know, they probably had flip phones back then. There was no iPhones, iPads, you know, any of technology. Forget that. You know, when you release somebody now from 25 years ago, I can't even remember 25 years ago. But I think the internet was just getting, like, people didn't, they had dial up. There was no Bluetooth, you know, there was no, like, think of the driver's license, you know, they never had phone pay, you know, and then say, okay, go to society now and get a job and support yourself. And, you know, most of us were eased into that. We weren't just thrown out there and say, okay, and so I can see where how these people are failing. You know, how can you, you know, here's a cell phone. What the heck is a cell phone? And, you know, how does it work? You know, we remember these very wealthy people had cell phones back then. Not everybody had a cell phone, you know, in the mid-90s, early 90s. That wasn't something everybody had. Internet service was not something that was very common. You know, it was, people had it. It was a big dial-up landline thing. And people didn't carry around laptops, iPads, you know, self-checkout at the grocery store. You know, all of these things that we take for granted every day, these people are, you know, instead of, you know, they lived with mom and dad. They didn't have to pay bills. They didn't have to have insurance. They didn't have to have all of this stuff that, and they certainly didn't have to pay it every month. I mean, these are all responsibilities that we kind of grow into. And, you know, I could see where committing a crime and going back to jail is a whole heck of a lot easier than having to try to provide for yourself or your, a family. If, you know, you got married in prison, now all of a sudden you're expected to be a husband or a wife and support somebody. That's a lot to take on with 6 months preparation, you know. And you're usually, you have a felony or, you know, a major conviction on your record. How are you going to get a job to afford all of that?
And if it's a high Corey doesn't help.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You're going to fail your Corey, you know, your Corey check. You're going to have a lot of explaining to do. There's very limited jobs. Mm-hmm. And if it's a high-profile case, someone knows your name, you know, you're blackballed in, like, nine communities right there. Like, where are you going to go? Because chances are, if you go back to the same neighborhood, you've got a problem. Everyone's going to know who you are. And what do you do? And can you go out of state? Probably not.
Even coming out, the people that they knew, even a lot of family members die off or something happens where they get just, you know, disconnected throughout the years. And these adolescents you're talking about, and they're 17, 18 years of age, they're coming out 20 years later, 25 years later, and they're in their 30s and 40s coming out.
Yeah.
And this some that went in when they were, you know, adolescents, and they're in their 16, 17.
And, like, mentally, you know, and there's been obviously trauma from prison and this and that, but, you know, they come out and they're – emotionally, you know, the last time they were out in the world, they were a child, and they don't know how to take care of themselves in society like a child, because that's all they ever did. Like, what are they, you know, how are they, it's incomprehensible how the society can expect them, put the same expectation on them as any other person, 35 or 40, or 45, you know, to then say, okay, now you act like a 35, 40-year-old and do your job, because it's impossible. It's a setup for failure. And so I was looking. Texas has a program, and I'm actually going to reach out to these people. There's a couple of programs, and what they did was they got in touch with these entrepreneurs, and they started a residential facility. And it's a Fortune 500 company, mentors people, felons, and gets them, from what I've researched on them, mentors them, gives them jobs in their, you know, Fortune 500 companies while they work in a while they live in a residential facility, and trains them to be businessmen, which I thought was really cool. And
You know, they did have it one time. CETA. And
yeah.
I don't know why they did away with it. It helped so many people at that time. I don't know why they did away with it.
This organization, is a one, and it only works. It works with the Texas prison. A bunch of businessmen, like I guess it looks like attorneys and other like men who own other corporations and stuff like that. I guess sponsor felons who are released, and they work with the prison system. They're a volunteer agency, and people can apply to get in there, and they work with them, and they transition them straight. They go straight out from prison. We were talking about residential places, so I was trying to see what other places were around. And this one is in Texas that does it. And I was like, that would be amazing if more states would look into programs like this and people would volunteer, like people in the community. And something like that could be in all states and, all over, because evidently it's very successful. I mean, these people are motivated. They, are at a job that provides, they can earn an income at, that is one that can sustain a family and sustain, they're not working at $12 an hour, minimum wage, part-time, they're working at a job that they could, like I said, afford to, eventually buy a house and, have a life. And they know about their criminal record, obviously, and they still give them an opportunity to get a job that could provide for a family, and which I think is great. And I think, if more places, especially for the youth offenders who, did something horrible, but they did something horrible when they were a teenager, and they've really never given an opportunity to, change, and they probably, they've made a change, but there was no possibility that they were ever staying in jail for the rest of their life. They were coming out, and we should have, as a society, planned for that and do our best to make sure that they don't end up back in jail,
Yeah.
And
I don't know if you ever heard of HIRE. H-I-R-E.
H-I-R-E. Oh, HIRE. Yeah. I thought you said HIRE. Yes.
No,
yeah,
HIRE.
I haven't heard of it.
My Cape Cod accent hasn't gone away.
Yeah, no, I get my Boston one back, but not right now. But yes.
It said the HIRE program, the HIRE Now program, has received very high demand from employers, and no new employer pre-registrations are being accepted at this time. They do hiring and they do training of ex-offenders, which is good. This has been around for a long time, but apparently they've made a lot of changes to it too. They have, it says employers and employees must meet certain criteria to be eligible. But this is a program that has helped a lot of people coming out of prison to obtain jobs. Uh-huh. They used to help with bond issues too, but I don't know if they still do because I haven't really checked into it for a long time.
Yeah. And then there was a city year that I don't know if that's still around. That was one that was trying to, I don't know if that's still in Boston. They used to have the kids, that was like an alternative program. RISE was another program that they had for reentry into, like it is, entry program, but see if they have it in Massachusetts. I think they have it in Massachusetts, I'm looking at it right now to see. I think that was the one I couldn't remember the name of a couple weeks ago.
Mm.
I think that was the one in Malden. Let me see. I kept thinking it was called CARE, but it was RISE.
Yeah, hiya. Another thing I think, the United States, they have to start changing things. I mean, they're going by a constitution and all these things that were written up hundreds of years ago, almost. But What they need to start doing is becoming more consistent, and they need to start doing things on a consistent basis throughout the United States. Every state should get on the same path. They should do the same thing, the criteria, the rules, the policies. Everything should be simultaneously, they should all be the same. And
yeah,
that way, I don't think there'd be as much confusion, because it's so devastating that some incarcerated individuals get a sentence that others don't get because they're in the wrong state. And the voting rights, I don't think, should have ever been taken away from the incarcerated individuals, because the crimes have nothing to do with going against their own country. And I don't think it was right that, and I here we have two or three states that have never taken away the rights of prisoners to vote, even those who are currently incarcerated. They have never taken away the rights, so they're still allowed to vote in those three states, whereas every other state, they've taken away the rights. For what reason? It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, like, that's the United States does. I mean, they have, you either have this as a country, or you have it as, I mean, I can't remember which law it was, the one that decided to make every state its own sovereign state. So, I mean, and that part of that goes with the national laws and the state laws. So,
it's like,
but I think there's certain crimes. Yeah.
The four Commonwealth states, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, Virginia, and
Kentucky, I think, or not, one of those other states.
But
even that doesn't make sense. Four states in the whole United States that are Commonwealth states. Then you have three states that have never taken away rights to vote for anyone that's a citizen of the United States, whether incarcerated or not. And then you have all these different things going on, and it's like, where does it end? I mean, it just is so dysfunctional.
Well, yeah, and then you have the lack of enforcement, it doesn't matter, all across the board. I mean, California is an example of, you know, if you think the states are bad, you should see how the counties are here. The counties are run like their own states. So, you know, what's good for one county is completely different in another county. And so you have... the counties are literally run like states. And California is like its own country. It's absolutely, it's a train wreck.
You must have seen a big difference being from Massachusetts and then living in California. You must have seen a lot of changes between the, you know, the states.
I see. I remember we used to joke when I was in Massachusetts, I mean, working in Massachusetts, working for the state, and they would say California is its own country. And I mean, the laws and everything I know in Massachusetts. And then I came here and I went to school out here for criminal justice and stuff. And I argue with the teachers. And I know Commonwealth and Massachusetts law. And, you know, I would be like, oh, it's breaking and entering. Breaking and entering doesn't exist. What are you talking about? No, there's no, like, B&E is not a law. It's, you know, there's burglary, but there's no B&E. I'm like, that's breaking and entering. That's a blue law. I don't know if it's not. It's a Commonwealth law only. And, you know, there's certain things that are very, you know, it's hilarious. I'm like, okay. I said, I get some of the blue laws, but, you know, some of those
I remember
are
years
funny.
Ago, years ago when we did national work, we had a lot of clients in California. It was, we worked with Bakerville, California, and we worked with Corcoran, and they had Coalinga State Hospital, and that was pretty good, because they would, you know, they would send someone. I know we had a client that actually was at Coalinga State, but we also worked with people from Susanville, and there's names I couldn't even pronounce. It starts with a T, an Indian name. But we worked with quite a few prisons and prisoners in those various prisons.
Yeah, there's a lot. They're up in the northern area. I mean, I have, like, I'm near the jails where the county lockups, like the pretrial, but basically like the Nashua Street. Like, that's probably the closest thing to me, and a couple of juvenile detention centers. But those, I mean, those are the actual state facilities. They are out far away, but the like what I consider the equivalent of Nashua Street. You know, within that
going off,
an hour or so.
Going off track just a little, are you anywhere near all those fires that have been occurring in California?
I was near the Root Fire, which that was the big one that was by me. And
the
we just have the spot fire. The Root one was in Santa Clarita not that long ago. It was a couple weeks.
Do you know if any of the prisons were near any of those areas where the fires were taking?
The ones in North, unless they're in North, like Cochrane and like Acapulco, those are all in Northern California. So unless the fires are in Northern California, which I think some of them are, but I don't think they're that close to my knowledge.
I remember a while back, they actually had some prisoners, and these were probably prisoners that were going to be released soon anyway, but they had brought in some prisoners to actually help with with putting out the fires.
Actually, I'm looking right now. There's a thing on the history of the California Inmate Firefighter Program. So they do have some of them working as first responders. And this was written in last month. Well, this last month, actually. They do have some working in California as first responders, I'm guessing up in North. This was just for September 1st, 2022. There's an initiative that puts them as first responders. And I guess they've been doing it since the 40s. I did not know.
And
so they bring them in.
That brings me back to what you were saying about, you know, a lot of these prisoners that are inside, a lot of them, you know, they've done something for a one-time event, you know, that caused them to go to prison. And seeing those kind of things and seeing how they're using the prisoners when emergencies come up, it almost demonstrates that this is what we need to do, is give them another chance and get them out there to do a lot of these things.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, I'm looking at what they do with the program that they have, actually. Actually, the outcome has been really good. My question is, do they then go hire them? If they gave them jobs afterwards, that would be even better.
Or even a stipend, you know,
they get paid. The pay per day is $2.90 to $5.
Wow.
Which, I mean, I don't know. You know, in the grand scheme of things, they do have free room, free board, free food. So for years and years and years and years and years, that the taxpayers pay for. So, I mean, they should get paid something. I don't know what a fair wage is. I would say, you know, minimum wage is $12. So, I mean, I don't know what the going rate is. I think $2.90 is pathetic. But then again, if you work at a restaurant, the going rate is $3 an hour plus tips. Still.
I don't know if you've ever heard of Teen Challenge, but Teen Challenge, I was talking to some formerly incarcerated individuals one time. This was quite a few years ago. But Teen Challenge, they have thrift shops all over the place. And I was talking to some people that were working at the thrift shop, and they said that Teen Challenge gives them a roof over their head, but they work them like 60 hours a week.
Well,
and
that's
taking,
no.
Exactly.
No.
It's not taking, but Salvation Army, they also work with formerly incarcerated as well. I don't know what the Salvation Army does as far as, you know, them working with the formerly incarcerated. But I do know that Salvation Army does a lot for incarcerated and homeless people as well.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, I think if you're going to, if they're working and they're not in prison, they should be making a minimum wage or more, giving, you know. I don't know what the actual fair, that's like cost of living and this and that, you know, I don't know, taking in, I don't know if you should, you know, minimum wage, I think. I don't know what a fair price is. If they're giving housing and all of that.
If they're giving them a place to stay, then I could see paying minimum or, you know, giving them a few dollars here and there to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the firefighting, you know, the $6 an hour if they're getting, if minimum wage is 12, they get 6 because they're getting all of their stuff paid for. I'm not going to argue that one. But the $2 an hour, I think, is a little low considering you're out fighting. It's a top job. It's not a, like they're going in and answering phones in an air-conditioned office. You know, that's a top job. But on the other hand, when they get out, if they can go get a job, they're trained. That's also education paid for. So, I mean, that's a pretty good deal. You know, and then I know that there's a lot of the college programs in the reality, the college programs they give, and I think people, and this is my beef a little bit with it, they give them, you know, they have to earn it with good behavior, and some of these people that are coming up getting law degrees are never going to get released. Now, what good is a law degree if you're never in? These should be going to the people, and the college degrees should be going to the people that are going to be getting out of prison. That's what should be. Let's start and focus on the people who are getting out of prison. The younger people, the people who have a parole hearing in 4 years, 5 years. Let's, you know, focus on the people that are transitioning out, and because these are the people that need to be placed in a facility. And focus on transition and, like, you know, look at. I think that's what we need to focus on. But then again, then they change a law, and this is what they did in California. All of a sudden, these people that had very lengthy sentences, they said, okay, we just changed the law, you're all out tomorrow. And they basically left everybody out of jail. So with no services put in place or anything, and they let them all out on the streets, which, again, isn't fair to them.
I think they should have pilot programs. I think after certain prisoners after 10 years to have a pilot program and, you know, put them out there, give them a place to stay and you know, have them do all this, you know, these either volunteer or whatever. Give them a place to stay, a roof over their head, and give them a few dollars a week, but a pilot program. Some of them who maybe have a sentence of 20 years, you know, do the pilot project so that they're out in 10 years and see how it works. Those who have been in for, say, 30 years, you know, give them, after 20 years, give them, you know, an opportunity, the same thing, a pilot project.
That's what I was thinking. Or a step, like when we had the residential, we had a step down. You know, you were in the acute, and then you were stepped down to, you know, more privileges, still supervised, still. And then when you were successful in that, then you stepped down to a less restrictive environment, and, you know, you sort of eased your way in, you know. The environment became less restrictive as you could demonstrate you could handle the responsibilities, and you learned how to acclimate yourself into society. And I think that sort of approach, and especially if somebody's behind bars for so long, you know, transitioning slowly. I mean, you start transitioning, you know, almost like, you know, group home, and then you start then independent living, and then that sort of a thing. But you have to sort of step down and transition slowly, because people transition different, you know, and that's kind of my thinking on that whole thing. I mean, you just don't, because I think of it a lot as the same as people who've been locked up in a patient unit. You can't, and they're same fragile, emotionally fragile. They're the same, it's the same anxiety, it's the same fears, the same confusion. When you're let out of a hospital, you're in an institutionalized environment. It doesn't matter if it's a prison or if it's in a locked ward. The difference is between a locked ward, because we don't have institutionalization like we used to, you're not locked in a ward for 10 years anymore, or 20 years, or 30 years. You're left in a ward for 30 days. But you get so used to that predictability and that stability. You know you're going to eat at 5. You know you're going to have lights out at 10. You know at 7 o'clock in the morning you're going to get woken up, and you know what your day is going to be like every second of the day. And there's no question. You know, there might be some excitement like a fight, but you know pretty much what your day is going to be. It is structured to the minute. And that is the same in prison. Life is not like that.
No. I think a lot of fights, too, a lot of these riots that they have, I think it's instigated not by, I mean, prisoners are going to fight, I'm sure. But I think a lot of it is out of frustration. Because there's a lot of prisoners, if they all had jobs while incarcerated or education, and they were all in classes or they were all doing some kind of prison work program, they would be doing something. They would be separated from others. They would be doing their job. But what they do, and this is the Department of Corrections, because of prisons for profit, they target prisoners. And a lot of prisoners, they deny them to participate in any kind of programs. These prisoners are sitting in their cells day in and day out, not having anything to do, and all it's doing is giving them more stress, high blood pressure, you know, frustration. Yeah. And this is why a lot of these prisoners, unfortunately, it's not their fault. It's the fault of the overseers. And this is why the politicians need to go in and stop prisoners, hearing them.
That's the thing. Well, then you'll ask why, and they'll say because we don't have funding. So, you know, well, where's the funding? You know, and it's kind of ridiculous. Then you wonder why you have problems. So, you know, they say it's because of the funding issue. We can't afford it, whatever. Then, you know, you wonder why, you know, you don't hear that. Actually, that'll instigate more mental health problems, because when you're sitting in a cell all day, you're going to go nuts. It's a no-brainer. Anyone who wasn't crazy would be crazy by the end. You know, the littlest thing is going to set you off. The person next door making a funny noise that you don't like is going to drive you crazy. Even if you weren't crazy to begin with, you'll be crazy by the time you're done. And that's human nature. And, you know, if people were occupied and had more to do and had more structure. And unfortunately, the things like education and the ability to go to substance abuse groups and the ability to go to therapy, a lot of that is earned. You know, you have to have good behavior. Well, how can you, you know, by sitting in, you know, sitting nicely on your bed all day, you know, how many days of that can you do, or years can you do? And after you do that for X amount of time, then you can earn the right to get an education. Well, you know, that's hard to do for some people. You know, it really is. It's asking a lot.
It's actually putting the cart before the horse instead of the horse before the cart.
And instead, you should be saying, oh, this is what you're going to do. And you know, I think that's the difference between the mental health aspect and the prison aspect. I think working in an inpatient facility, it was like, no, this is, you are going to go to group and you are going to go to school and you are going to do this, or we're going to have a, you know, then if you don't do that, then, you know, sitting in your room was the last option you were going to do. You were going to stay busy because that's where the mental health, the approach is different than the prison approach, because it was like, you need to be doing something at all times. And that's what's missing. Really, I think it would absolutely teach a lot of the problems that they have.
I know that they need to have something to stimulate the mind, and they need to have, you know, some outlet. As you mentioned, not only on the outside, a lot of us through the pandemic, a lot of people were so frustrated because they were stuck in their houses all their time.
Exactly.
And this is only, maybe a couple of years. But these people have been in prison for years and years, and not only on top of being in a cage as it is confined now, but they were even more confined because they were only allowed out of their cells a couple of hours a day, and they weren't allowed to go to the gym or go to the library or any of these things.
I mean, I think all of us can sort of relate a little bit. I mean, being confined to your house, it made people who weren't crazy before crazy, and that was, and they weren't, we were in jail. Like, you know, I don't know how many people ended up, I think teletherapy became like a huge booming market at that point. You know,
You know, I always say we need to get this information out to people so that they can understand what's going on in the prison. Now, unfortunately, a lot of people are aware of these things because they either work for the Department of Corrections already, or they, you know, they have relatives in the Department of Corrections. And this is why a lot of these things don't really get addressed, because people that have relatives that are in law enforcement or in the Department of Corrections or in courts or whatever, they automatically have their mind set up that all these people are criminals, hardcore criminals, because my brother or my husband or whoever in my family is with the courts or with the prisons or with the law enforcement. They don't stop to think. And I learned years ago that a lot of these people married to people in law enforcement, there's a lot of abuses that go on in their own homes. And I had a friend that was a police officer for years, and he was very, very strict with his daughter because they want their families to be perfect. A lot of them want their families to be perfect, and they fail to realize kids growing up, sometimes you can be too strict. You can be too, you know, too strict with your children, and they're going to act out.
But I agree and I disagree. I think that's true for a lot of families, and regardless of whether or not they're in law enforcement or the Department of Corrections. I mean, I've had a lot of friends who have worked for the Department of Corrections, and their families have been in court and law enforcement, and they've been very open-minded and very, you know, they were not involved, you know, they just didn't have that mindset whatsoever, and, you know, and at all, and they were very liked in the prisons where they worked and very respected by, you know, they worked, one of them worked at Nashua Street, and we would be out, you know, we'd be out for dinner and we'd see people that were on their floor, and they'd be come up to us and buy us beer and like, hey, you know, you were a great guard when we were in there, thank you very much. And, you know, it was, you know, we'd see them, and that's always nice when you see people. You know, I'd see clients out, and, you know, when people respect what you do and thank you for treating them with respect and stuff like that. And so I don't think everyone's like that. And, you know, there are bad people everywhere. And
not everyone is like that. But as someone once said on Facebook, when it was a prison guard, I believe, said that he wasn't like the others that were abusive and all this. He was saying that he wasn't like that. And some man responded and said, you may not be like them, but if you're not exposing them, then you're part of the problem too, or something like that, which is true. And I don't know if it's because they're afraid of their peers or be afraid of the union, but I had a friend. Psychiatric nurse. She's a psychiatric nurse, worked in a prison in the central part of the country, and she was getting along with a lot of the guards. They really liked her. They joke around and everything. Until she saw some guards abusing, and when she mentioned something about it, she started to complain about it. That's when they all turned against her, and she ended up leaving. So these things do happen.
Yes, no, you're right. I will amend what I say, because yes, there was a situation like that. If you know people who left, they left instead of put up with. They did not want to be a part of what was going on in this particular situation, and instead they left. So. And I had people who have left places where they did not like what was going on or respect what was going on. I left positions where I did not like what was going on because I did not want to be a part of it. And I didn't agree with the politics, didn't agree with the situation, didn't agree with how the administrator was not going to, and I made sure I left a big thing in writing of why I was leaving. And, you know, did not want to be a part of it. And, you know, whether it was treatment of people or policies that they endorsed, you know, I'm not agreeing with them, I'm not going to be working for that particular agency. You know,
it's like Miriam Jacobs always says when she comes on, the differences between the countries, and even, you know, Germany and Norway, they don't only treat the incarcerated totally differently. They call them by names. They talk to them like they're friends. And here we are in the United States. The prisoners are called by numbers. They're mistreated. Yeah. They're in, you know, some steel and cement behind some steel and cement walls. If these things don't happen, if they're not in place in all these other countries, and they're seeing all this success and such a low recidivism rate, if at all, then our political leaders should try to follow suit and meet with these people, find out what their secret is, and use it in this country. But in this country, we always have to be the big shots. We always have to do it our way, and our way is not working.
Well, that's what my thing was. Somebody on a social media website went off. They were very, rightfully so, upset with the homeless situation where I am right now because, like I said, it's an epidemic. And most of them are mentally ill, and most of them are a result because of them letting incarcerated, changing laws and just letting them. I don't know. I think someone said 86,000 people out of prison was the last count. And there are 86,000 homeless people in Los Angeles, I think, at this point. So, and I proposed my, I said, basically, the people are going to get out. So instead of addressing the yelling about it, basically, what needs to be done is, everyone knew that 86,000 people were eventually going to get out of prison. They were, look at what could have been done to prevent them from being homeless before they got out of prison. So, it starts long before they get out of prison. The problem needs to get addressed long before they're released and prepared for it. Because if they were trained, if they were educated, if someone had intervened with substance abuse counselors, psychologists had intervened, there was interventions put in 2 or 3 years ago to prepare them for being released, there wouldn't be 6,000 homeless people.
I think they should start the transition period as soon as they get sent to prison.
Exactly.
They should start the transition period.
Exactly.
They get to prison, get them involved in all kinds of services, rehabilitative programs. They should start doing all these things as soon as they get into prison. And then, like you say, step down as time goes on, get up to a lesser area, a lesser program, a lesser facility.
And step down, and I understand that, people go to prison. There's the way I look at it is from what I've seen and what I've observed and what I've talking to people. It's almost like a grieving period. Like, that's the best way I can describe it. There's like an anger period where there's a lot of them, there's like a period of fighting, fighting the behavior problem. And it's the same I've noticed with some people when they are impatient, they're fighting it. And then they come to realize this is what it is and accepting it. And then they're ready to do what they need to do. What do I do? How do I change? Or what do I need to do? And once get to that point, they're good to go, and they start making the changes that they need to make. And for some people, it's very quick, it's immediate. For some people, it's not so immediate. And everyone's different, and they have different things. And that's where mental health comes in, and that's where education comes in, and that's where keeping people busy comes in. Because I think a lot of the anger and the frustration when you're stuck in a room for hours and hours and hours a day. Self-harm, the suicide attempts, especially in the beginning, mental health is crucial. Like, are looking at, it's a very stressful and chaotic time. And, yes, this person may have done something horrible, but you need to look out for, their mental health and mental well-being. And by just putting on suicide watch with an untrained person who patrols the room every 15 minutes is not how you do it. There needs to be a little bit more. Who's not a psychologist or anything?
You know what I often think about, too? I remember watching on the news one time. This was maybe about a year ago. There was a man, and I forgot what state it was in, but he shot and killed a couple of police officers. It was some kind of shootout. And this was a Caucasian man. And what they did, they one of the police officers died. I think the other one was seriously ill in the hospital. I don't know if he ever made it. But when they brought that man to court, his whole face was so bruised. It was all black and blue, the whole face. I mean, but they must have beat him to a pulp. And I remember thinking for the longest time after that, what has ever happened to that man? He's still in prison, but no one... This is where I say when these things happen, no one follows up. No, the media, they talk about these issues and the police officers and how this man did this. And they showed the man that one time with his face so badly bruised. And I wondered, and I know there's cases like this, other cases like this, and I often wonder whatever happened to these people, no one goes in to oversee, to find out or talk about what happens to them. And I often wonder, where are they? Do they still have them in a solitary confinement? Have they been beating him every day? Have they been violating him? What has happened to a lot of these people? And that's why it's so. When Pham sent that notice around for everyone to encourage their lawmakers to go into the prisons and meet with the prisoners, I think they need to meet with the people that went in under those circumstances. They need to find out if they're still even alive.
Case management until 6 months before you're discharged. So they should have case managers when they get put into prison.
No, they have case managers. Every block, every place has case managers.
Yeah.
But the case managers is not what I'm talking about at so much. It's, you know, like has is a
like
the medical providers. Are they seeing these people? Are they?
But it doesn't, they have like managers, but they don't have like coordinators. Like, that's what I'm saying. Somebody who oversees the medical and all of that. So like a case coordinator, like that would be, I think they do. They just have somebody assigned to, you know.
I think what I'm trying to say is independent. We all know that the department has these places, these people that are supposed to do so many things, but from experience, I know that they don't. And that's why there's so many organizations trying to get independent providers to go into the prison.
Yeah.
Look at Donna Winnett from the from Family and Friends of the Mentally Ill. Look at they've been negotiating with Mass General Hospital. Mass General Hospital's ready to send people in, and the Department of Corrections trying to prevent it. This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We need independent providers, but I'm wondering what happens.
Interesting. Because Mass General Hospital used to work, well, they worked with National Street. I'm surprised that they're...
National Street isn't so much a prison.
It's a jail. It's a facility. It's right next door. But that's what I thought it was interesting because they were the sole providers for National Street and for South Bay. But,
there's such a difference between jails and prison.
Yeah, there's a difference. Yeah, no, I know. I just thought it was interesting that, I mean, because it was run, that they could give, like, I just thought it was.
Although even in jails, they should have oversight, independent oversight. But I think, again, the legislative members, I mean, they're talking about all this criminal justice reform, but what do they know about actually what's going on inside? They don't go inside. They might hear it from a couple of politicians here and there that do go in. But they should be going in themselves. If they're going to be fighting for criminal justice or, you know, prison reform, they should be going in to see and to talk to the prisoners to find out what they're reforming.
Yeah.
This is what's so ridiculous. Our legislative members are supposed to be fighting for criminal justice reform, and they have not a clue of everything that goes on behind those walls. It's like the media. The media reports one-sided news before they get all the facts.
Yeah, I don't trust the media for...
No, me
anything.
Either. That's one thing I will say. Fake news as it was once said by Donald Trump.
It's one-sided, and it's why even, I was looking to see who was in charge of, the last thing, Criminal Justice Reform Act of 2018, I can't read. If there's anything new coming in there, I just, in the next election, but I
just see the last one in 2020. But I was looking to see who the key person was actually on it.
I don't know how many people are familiar with Jean Gore. Jean Gore is the founder of the National Shattering Silencing Coalition. And they've done a lot of good work, too. They consist of, you know, all kinds of individuals, advocates, you know, family members and other organizations joining forces. And they make calls on behalf of a lot of them. And they do a lot. And I had spoken the possibility of having Jean come on sometime. But Jean and hopefully Jean and Donna Winnett will connect. They have connected. They are going to be working together. And hopefully they'll be able to come on together, too, on the show to talk about, you know, some of these things. But it's called the National Silencing, Shattering Silencing Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
That can be found on the internet.
Yeah, I'm on the internet now. I'm looking at this, the Rise organization is one that I've been looking at in the mall. And
I try to connect these organizations around the country and, you know, these like the American Union with Brian Winters from Vermont and Society First with Denise Caffey and FAM and Cure with Charlie Sullivan. Charlie Sullivan started Cure, he and his wife, in 1975, I believe it was. And they also have their national, and they have a lot going on, too, as far as, you know.
I was trying to look up that Heaven's House. I don't find that anywhere.
What was that?
Unless I, at Kevin's house, you guys were talking about a week ago. I wasn't able to find that. I haven't been reminded anywhere. I don't know if that's still an active organization. The one that I was looking at in Texas, which was the Prison Entrepreneurship Program, I think it's called. I'm looking it up now. Prison Entrepreneurship, yeah. And this is like where this program looks really, I wish they would expand it. They have them doing a lot of community work. And
I haven't heard of that one. It's called the Prison Entrepreneurship.
Yeah, it's out of Texas right now. But they work with men and women in the prisons, and they work with them transitioning out. They're Houston and Dallas. I would really like to talk to them, actually. But they do actually. I'm on the website again today, right now. They do.
That might be good if you could talk to them and find out.
Yeah, I think I might talk to them.
Find out if they would let you interview them.
Yeah, because they talk about their program and they do some big interviews with people who graduated the program. And they get them into, I guess, construction, also landscaping, but they work with and start companies. They use their description. Who we are. They are, they used to build houses. And they have amazing results, according to them. They have opportunity for fresh start for refund inmates who thrive on challenge and accountability. They entrepreneurial passion, education, mentoring, and it's a residential program, but they focus on working and connecting them with services in the community and giving them jobs and that sort of stuff. But I like the fact that it's a residential, so it reintroduces. So it's not, you go basically straight from prison there, and then you start to get reintroduced into society. It's not, let's throw you out on the street, and you get educated, and you get skills, and by the time you graduate the program, you're, again, one step closer to being self-sufficient, which I think is, which is important. And so they have 100% of their people have the employment within 90 days, and 500 business services have been launched by our graduates. So we had an 8.3 recidivism rate to the national average. So since 2004, which is pretty good. And our graduates make anywhere from $13 an hour to $24 an hour.
State is in
I can send you the link. That they've gotten awards and things like that for social justice volunteer service and stuff like that.
Is it new?
They started in 2004, but 2017 is, I think, when they really took off.
Okay.
2,600 people. So, but yeah, this is one I've been looking at. This is a model for different places. So, I was looking just at basically different. I was looking at across the country, different what they had available and like rankings, how they differed and how they were similar. Well, it was in Massachusetts, and that wasn't that much in Massachusetts. There's a lot in other states, but let's see. Like the main that coming up, like Rise, I guess, is pretty much that one was the big one in. I've seen that all over the place in Massachusetts. But it's got a bunch of things that and like things offered through the Archdiocese of Boston has some programs, but you know, there's some private companies that have them, but they're small. A lot of independent things, because I was looking for things to recommend to people. And there's not a lot out there right now. So Massachusetts.
And that's the problem. That's the problem. There's not a lot of resources that could be beneficial to helping these people when they come out. But like I said, even with the shelters, they put people in a homeless shelter to sleep at night and throw them out in the daytime just to go back to whatever they were doing before. And nothing works. All this money going into these so-called, you know, resources that are supposed to help people, and all it does is make people worse, and they're not making any changes. It's the same old, same old. We don't have any smart legislative members that will stick to this and will really try to push for these changes, because it's been going on for years and years and years. Nothing changes except the problems are escalating, the crime is on the rise, the prisons are overfilled. The people are not getting the treatment in prison that they should be getting. A lot of them are reintegrated. These are major issues that haven't been addressed for years.
And I mean, that is, you know, and I think in some ways, letting people out isn't a solution either. If you're letting people out that are unprepared to be out, I think that's just as cruel. And then let them go, but let them go if just to fail society is just cruel.
They're coming out. They're coming out without a clue. But this is the whole plan. This is what the whole plan is. Let them come out. Yeah. Let them commit crime again, and the recidivism rate. Put them back in jail. Yeah. So these corporate offices are constantly making money off of these failed prison system.
The corrections officers aren't making that much money. They're not the ones making the money. They're the lowest bottom feeders. Someone's making money, but it isn't the corrections officers. The corrections officers are the people, the food chain. They're the bottom.
A lot of them are benefiting because a lot of them, how many prisoners have gone into prison and had their televisions taken all the time? Had a lot of their personal property taken all the time.
They do. But the prison officers don't get a bonus for that.
Yeah. It's not like they get a, they don't get a bonus in their paycheck for that. I mean, they're the ones, the direct workers don't get, like, you know, they don't get incentives at the end of the month for every TV they take away. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't, I mean, I think they're disgruntled and angry and frustrated, but they're making not that great pay. And, you know, the only thing that they've got going for them is it's a government job and they get a pension at the end of it all. Like, but they don't get, don't make that great money. Like, they really
don't. You know, you say they don't get a great pay. Now, Maura Healey, the Attorney General's office in Massachusetts, she did an investigation on the state troopers, the state police.
They get better pay. I know about
that. found out that not only was the director getting high pay, but they were also putting in for time that they weren't working. They were having others clock them in while they were out enjoying themselves. Well, this is the same thing with the people in the penal system. A lot of them are clocking out. A lot of them are not showing up. And when they don't show up, my experiences with prisoners around the country, when they don't show up, what happens is they leave the prisoners in their cells longer because those people are not showing up, but they're getting paid for it. When these police officers and others in the communities commit a crime, they get put on paid leave. Why would they get put on paid leave while they're doing an investigation on something that was already seen in videos that show that they did something that was very illegal?
They're in a union. That's why.
Yes.
They have very strong unions. And I'm not a union person. So I don't like having to join unions. I don't like having to pay union dues. I don't like having to deal with the union rep. And the unions, I can tell you from having a friend who was a CEO number of years, the unions are tough, and you know, the people in the unions are tough, and especially if you're the low man on the totem pole, if you're like, I believe, a white shirt, or a blue shirt, I can't remember, they were white or blue Massachusetts first, I think you're a white shirt first, you're the white shirt, you know, you're basically, you know, you keep quiet, you do your job, and you don't want to mess with, the union tells you what to do, you do it, and, you know, and you get bullied. Some of them are bullied as just the people who are incarcerated. Some of the CEOs, it's not an easy job.
Defund the union because the union's getting.
I think the unions in that. And I don't know about the police officer, but I can tell you the CEOs. You know, it's not an easy job. I think as you get higher up in it, the pay is better. The responsibilities are not as demanding, and that's where a lot more of the, I think the illegal activity goes on, the higher you get up in there. The hours aren't, you know, you're not doing forced overtime. You know, that's for a lot of the misuse of stuff goes on from what I've seen. And I've seen stuff.
Yeah.
And it was higher up necessarily. They were still COs, but it wasn't the lowest of the COs. It was that, you know, couple ranks higher than the lowest.
I really encourage people to start looking into the DOC's the penal system entirely around the country, because people don't see, they might see it here and there in a few prisons, they might see it in a couple of states, but until they see the whole picture, they don't understand exactly, you know, what goes on in the manipulation of prison officials with the legislative members and also with people in the community that are calling them. But we have about 5 more minutes, Jen, so I'd like you to close with whatever information you want to bring out or whatever you want to say to the audience.
In the case I saw the misconduct, they did get in trouble. They were terminated. So I put that out there. So there was action taken, and they did lose jobs. So
There were prisoners that told me one time, though, this is another, I want to real quickly say this. There were prisoners that had mentioned that when some correctional officers had, they were caught in illegal action activities, they were supposedly fired, but the prisoners said they weren't really fired. They were moved to other prisons, and they were put on office duty where nobody could say that they were still working with the department. They just weren't working in the area or the field that they was initially working, but they didn't get fired
as it was mentioned.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Catholic Church. They go on a ministry of leave and they go to another church. But, I mean, unfortunately, like I said, there's bad people in every single profession. I mean, really, I mean, the schools, the churches, the synagogues, the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts. Crime is one of those things that will never be, you can't avoid it. You do your best to prevent it or take action to make it decline. But unfortunately, you can never, it's never going to go away. That's what keeps lawyers in business and the courts in business. And there will always be bad people who never want to change their behavior. Luckily, the good people, most people want to change their behavior. And that's a good part of things. That's a good part of people. Even most people, when they make mistakes, you know, the good side to everybody, I believe, or most everybody. You know, there's always a couple people that, you know, I can't speak for, but most people like the choice they made, and there's a reason why. And once you get to know them and you can figure out what that reason is, you know, you realize that there's some good in them and that there's really a part of them that wants to change and just don't know how or is guided and confused. And, you know, they realize that they could, there's some penalty and, you know, that's okay, but they're willing to make change. And, you know, we need to be more interested in, you know, working with these individuals because most of them will get out. They're going to be society's problem. So if you want society to be more productive than it is now, then, you know, we need to be open-minded to work with them and to prepare them, or we're going to have a huge epidemic more than it is now on our hands because the laws are just getting more lenient about, and the prisons are just getting more overcrowded, and, you know, it's everything is just, the system is broken, and, you know, it needs to be addressed, and it needs to be fixed, and cities like the one in Texas, like, you know, organizations like that are fantastic, and more organizations need to seem to take a look at that, or look at the other ones in, that need to come together to start helping to transition people out. That's fantastic. A 8% recidivism rate out of, you know, 2,600 people is pretty good. Imagine if we had more of that. So I like that. That's a sign.
I would just like people to know, no one is born bad. You know, I look at children a lot of times. I'll look at these little children, and they're so innocent and so helpless and so beautiful. And yet, years and years later, you know, you might run into the same ones that are either in prison or they're in the streets or totally. And I'm sure a lot of you that have gone to school, you know, and you, all of your school friends, when you've gone to reunions or later in years, you see them, and they look totally different. You know, the beards, the hippie type things or whatever. But no one is born bad. One of the things we have to learn in this country, we all have to start getting into knowing about various cultures in the country. We live in the United States, and everyone is united from countries. They're representatives from countries all over the world. We all know that cultures make a big difference in the way people are disciplined, in the way people are taught. There's even in the homes, there's cultures, because no two people under the same roof are exactly alike. So we have to realize if we learn about one another's cultures, if we learn about others, the way that they were raised, and we have to look at the crimes that are committed, we have to look at where they went wrong, from these innocent children to children that were either taught to hate or taught to be violent or were so badly abused that they grew up with that hatred in them or that anger or that mental illnesses that caused them to go after innocent people because they're not thinking rational. We have to look at a lot of these places where they were coming from poor poverty homes where there was no food, not much of anything, and they would go out and rob a bank or rob a grocery store. You know, and look at California. They started the three strikes law. They could have been minor offenses, but after three times, they ended up getting life sentences. We have to look at all of the dynamics that go on in the lives of these incarcerated individuals because every situation is different, and everyone needs to take part of the blame. The parents, the law enforcement, the pastors, priests, or whatever they want to call themselves in the churches, in the mosque, in the synagogues, they all are part of what should be done with the people in their communities. We have these people that are having these churches and everything talking about godliness, and yet you don't see them going into the prisons. You don't see them going out in the streets and talking to these individuals in the streets. But they're collecting all kinds of money from people. The Christ Jesus came into the world with nothing, walking around in sandals, not even having a place to lay his head. But we have to look at what our surroundings are, what our environment is, and why these people have failed is our own fault, everyone's fault, that claims to be godly, that is quick to judge. We have people protesting to abolish abortion, but yet a lot of these children that were born because the parent didn't want to give them up or have them aborted, are now in prisons. So where are these people that are pushing to have these abortions abolished or preventing them from taking contraceptives? Get them in the prisons, these judgmental people, to go into the prisons and learn more about the children that were saved, that somewhere along the line failed and are now serving life and life without parole sentencing. And those on death row, many of whom have been put to death only to find out months later or years later that they were actually innocent. Think about it, people. So we are now going to close this episode. Jen, thanks again for coming on. Next time you're going to be hosting the next time. you're wearing many hats, I'll tell you, and I appreciate it. Many
awesome.
Hats. But hey, audience, thank you so much. And thank you, Jen, for coming on. And I will hear from you next week, I'm sure. Mary and Jacobs will be on next Wednesday. So I don't know if you received the invite, but if not,
I didn't receive it yesterday. Yeah, I wasn't sure about yesterday because I didn't receive an invite, so I wasn't sure.
Okay. I will get it out to you. Again, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
And audience, thanks again for listening in. And we are now signing off.
Bye.